You're listening to Afropunk Solution Sessions. I'm your host, Bridget Todd.
And I'm your co-host, Eve Jeffcoat.
Afropunk is a safe place, a blank space to freak out in, to construct a new reality, to live our lives as we see fit while making sense of the world around us. Here at Afropunk, we have the conversations that matter to us, conversations that lead to solutions.
You might remember Sean Seifelwald from the episode that we did on prison abolition, prison reform, and mass incarceration early in the season. But Seifel also had a lot to say about intersex rights and the writing that he does. And the conversation that I had with him was just so good and so enlightening that we couldn't help but share the whole thing with you. The film that he talked about on the episode was a documentary that he has done called Letters to an Unborn Son that explores how incarceration really affects families. And he does that through the letters that his incarcerated father sent to him. But there's just this whole other world of things that Seifel is involved in. And it was just such an impactful conversation that we would love to share it with you all. So here it is. Are you guys cool with starting with by playing a game?
Sure.
Okay.
Games are fun.
So I'm just going to throw out a few words.
Okay.
And I want you to say the first thing that comes to your mind in relation to them.
Okay.
In terms of like activism or social justice.
All right.
Okay. Tired.
First thing that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. I just felt it.
I recognize that.
Like, oof. First thing in this moment is burnout. Do you want me to explain?
Yes, please. Please do.
So when I think about tired and burnout, I think about the people who are doing activist work, whether they be in the United States or abroad or globally, who are just putting in work and who are not properly funded and who are just doing this work because they care about this work and they really want to affect change. And so I can really see, depending on the issue that you're working on, it can be really, it can weigh on your heart, it can weigh on your spirit. So it's no surprise to me that people are tired. And I think there's a term that people throw around called burnout, where someone is like, okay, I'm going to stop organizing and I'm going to be a farmer, or I'm going to stop organizing and I'm going to work for the corporate, for a corporation because I'm just tired. So that's what came to mind.
Okay, cool. The next word is loud.
Ooh, loud. First phrase that came to mind was turn up. Turn up, get loud. I'm loud. I like being loud. And it reminds me of last year. So I'm an intersex activist. And as an intersex activist, I advocate for children, young adults, and infants that are born with bodies, sex traits, genitals, chromosomes that exist outside of what we consider normal for male and female, outside of this gender binary. And we planned an action in Chicago in front of Lurie Children's Hospital. And we were loud. We were loud. There was a cross-section of activists who were there. And it was great to be supported by different movements, people from trans movements, Black liberation movements, queer folks. And when you said that, the first image that came to mind was Pigeon, my comrade, my homie, my best friend, on the bullhorn, being loud, just really kind of screaming, not screaming, but yelling, because we were in front of Lurie Children's Hospital. It was a tall building, and projecting the sound upwards, right? So it's like, I feel like we have to raise our voices in some ways to be heard, especially for those of among us who are the most marginalized, the ones who are being persecuted in society, given our current administration. So I think it requires us to be loud, to push and advocate for our civil and human rights.
The next word is anger.
Ooh, anger. So another phrase, you say what comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good game. What comes to mind is Marvin Gaye. And so he recorded, I think, I forgot the year, but he recorded an album called Here, My Dear. So he was getting a divorce from his wife, Anne. And as part of the settlement, because she won, on his next album, he had to give her the proceeds. Because I think it was like a $1 million divorce settlement. And so he went into the studio, and I think it was probably one of his best albums because he just allowed himself to be creative. He was just like, I'm just going to pour out my spirit. I'm just going to experiment because he actually wanted to be a lounge singer. So he just allowed himself to just really be creative. And I think that's probably some of the best medicine if you're an artist. And so it totally sank. Album sales were so low. The critics came after the album like, this is the worst album of his whole career because I've got the album that preceded it, but it made him popular. It was like, what's going on? That was the album. So compared to this album, people were like, oh, this is horrible. So what was wild about that, one of the tracks on the album is called Anger, right? And I think he really embodied anger on the track. He was like, anger, when it's flaming hot, you know? And I was like, wow. Like, sometimes I think about that, when you can kind of feel and kind of embody that rage, because I think we live in a society where anger, especially if you're Black, right, we're not allowed to be angry, you know? And I do feel like, for me, what I say as a person who's Black, a person who's intersex, a person who's queer, I believe in righteous anger. And I believe it's a response to the conditions in which we're living. Those are my thoughts about anger.
Cool. The next word is woke.
Oh. Let me see. First, I'm telling you, you wanted the real.
Yeah,
this is the real.
Yes.
The first word that comes to my mind is disgust. Oh, man. I'll keep it 100. I hate the term woke. I hate the term woke. It's so annoying. And it's annoying because I feel like the people who describe themselves as woke are the most annoying people to me, you know? I'm like, so if you're woke, is everyone else sleeping? Like, I think we're in various stages of being aware, right? And I think sometimes there are those of us who see the conditions, who see what's going on, and it doesn't mean that we're not woke. It means that purposefully we're probably in denial, right?
That's very real.
You know?
Because we have a lot of unlearning we have to do, right?
For real. For real, you know? So I think for me, I think woke kind of establishes this hierarchy of knowledge, right? Like, I'm so woke, I know what's going on. And it's just like, I think we need to be humble, first and foremost. I think we really need to always, like you said, there's a lot of unlearning that needs to happen. For me, it's going to be a lifetime of unlearning because the conditions in which we exist and the things, even on psychic levels, of what we're told about what is right, what is not right, what is beautiful, what is not beautiful, how you present. Like, these are things that we have learned intrinsically that we have to unlearn. So I am very skeptical of people who describe themselves as woke, you know?
That's understandable. So we'll move on to the next word, which is ally.
First word that comes to mind is complicated. So I don't know if you've been in a workshop where people go around and they're like, name, prefer gender pronoun, or name and pronoun. And I'm just like, I'm sitting in my chair seething and feeling really uncomfortable. I'm like, because I feel like when we talk about allyship, what are we willing to do to be allies to someone? How uncomfortable are we willing to make ourselves in order to be allies, right? So I think, you know, to use gender as an example. So for me, my pronouns, quote unquote, are like he and him. And I've been in spaces where people are like, will like literally come up to me and bombard me like, oh yeah, you know, what's your pronouns? Don't even know my name. Don't even like know anything about me. And they want to know my pronouns, right? And they consider themselves allies. And I'm just like, where's the humanity, right? And I think sometimes it's like, allies can get kind of full of themselves, right? They're like, oh, you know, I'm an ally, you know. So, for example, a guy might be like, you know, I'm a feminist. I'm an ally with women. Meanwhile, saying and doing things that are so problematic, right? So I feel like with allyship, like how are we committed? Like you said, are we committed to that unlearning over time? Because there's a lot. If I want to be in allyship with someone, like, say, for an instance, someone who's disabled, there's just so many parts of that experience that I'm not going to know. So I can be an ally, but I have to be committed to unlearning things and to learn things about people with disabilities. I think for me, I can call myself an ally, but it's a provisional term for me because I always need to be humble.
I love that. And it kind of sounds, too, like you're saying, like, you need to take the time to listen as well. Like, people aren't doing enough listening.
That's real.
Too much talking.
People be talking like a timeline, mm-hmm. like a news feed. Real talk.
Let's not talk about news feeds.
You know? Oh, I forgot you're a millennial. It's just like I know all about that.
No. The next word is liberation.
Ooh. So it makes me think about freedom. I love using that term. And I think sometimes it's a grandiose term, liberation, right? That's mm-hmm. the term that I really love to use. It's almost like, so we're in Atlanta. We're in the city that gave birth to Martin Luther King. And I don't know whether he got it from someone or he came up with this, but there's an idea of the beloved community on earth, right? Like, how do we create that beloved community? So for me, whenever I talk about, I always use that term liberation. When I talk about intersex liberation, when I talk about Black liberation, when I talk about queer liberation, for me, it envisions a utopia. And I don't know if a utopia exists on earth, right? Because right now, things in the U.S. are looking kind of dystopic, right? But I think it's something that takes us up and beyond our current circumstances. So we're in the South. There are very deep roots in the South. My family has roots in the South. My mother was from North Carolina. My father was born and raised in Brooklyn, but his dad was from Mississippi. His mother was from Alabama. They have those roots there. A lot of Black people have roots in the South. And so, you know, I'm a collage artist. So as a collage artist, one of my, the people that I love to reference is Harriet Tubman. It's a shame that they're trying to put on a $20 bill. Such hypocrisy. But for her and other people who were confined, who were enslaved, for them to imagine freedom was insane. Because the conditions at that time meant that they could not be free, right? So they had a vision of liberation that was well beyond their current circumstances. So for me, in this dystopic framework, I'm like, what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to imagine liberation when everyone around you is saying that's impossible? And so for me, it's like the fortitude. It's the fortitude, it's the transgression of it that really inspires me.
So can you just tell me a little bit about your upbringing, your background, your personal story? Like, it seems that, like, your activism is really imbued with a lot of your personal story. Mm. And like, you talk about, like, you have a really fondness for the Bronx and, like, Ooh. Your childhood, like, you have great you know, memories that you really talk about.
You know, Boogie Down Bronx.
Yeah. and your experiences in the, like, medical system and all that. Like, I guess I'm wondering, too, while as you think about talking about your own personal story, like, what is it like to put yourself on the world stage like that? Does it feel necessary? Or, like, how is it? How important is it for you to tell your specific story? Like, you. This is about you when you're talking.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an amazing question. I don't know why I got all emotional. I guess I'm feeling emotional lately. Man. So, recently, I had a, I think you would appreciate this as a writer. I had an essay published in this magazine. It's a Southern magazine called Scalawag. And, you know, I talk about my mom, because she died last year. And I'm working on this documentary about my dad. And the way I like to think about those things, sort of using their story, using my story, is to talk about how we are surviving or how we have survived the United States. And even when we die, how we can, how our spirits kind of speak to that testimony or that our spirits testify about what it means to survive the United States. And so I think for me as an intersex activist, I cannot divorce myself from my blackness or my queerness because it's all happening at the same time. And I think it's my duty and my obligation in a long line of people who've came before me to be brave and to assert myself and to let people know that I existed, right? So when I die, because that's an inevitability, people can say, there was this person that existed in history. His name was Sean Cypher Wall. These are the things that he talked about. He left evidence that he existed, right? He refused to kind of be boxed in. He complicated things. And so I think in that survival, in that surviving the United States, I think is I only have one voice. I'm only one person. But if I can use my voice and my words and my body for the liberation of other people so that they may use their voice and use their words to free more people, then goddamn it, so be it. You know, that's if that's what I'm tasked with to do, that is what should be done. So that's why I do this work, you know, because I think we never, given our history as black folks, we never, we banded together and we knew our survival, our survival was based on collective survival. And that we needed to always be critical of this society in which we live. And that we should never be comfortable. I think there's a moment at which we need to rest. I think resting is important. I think our hearts need to rest. Our spirits need to rest. And I think we should always be vigilant and always be moving toward like this. I guess, dream or on this path of, like, liberation. Because we owe it to the people who will come after us, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's why I share my story. That's why my story feels important.
We'll be right back after this quick break. So you mentioned that you do collage art.
I do.
I'm curious about how that art plays a part in your activism. Mm. How do they work together?
So, as a collage artist, I use found objects, right? And I believe that these objects come together to create new things. And the work I create is a reflection of the circumstances. But I think it also, I think as an artist, I feel that I'm a medium through which, like, spirit can live and talk and breathe and sort of kind of appear on a two-dimensional surface. And so the themes that I engage or employ are themes in Black liberation, the extrajudicial killings of Black people. But I think I also use my work to speak to power, right? So the people in my artworks are not people who are victims or play into tropes that we're well familiar with, right? Like, how can we use the spiritual to actually empower people? I don't center power in my work, right? Like, I center the most marginalized in my work. And I kind of exalt them or give them dignity, right? So there was a piece that I just did about President Trump, and Paul Ryan's in there. And in the background, there's a poor white woman, right? And the title of it was, "And Now They Know." But now I'm sort of, I think the title of it now would be "The Great White Lie," right? Because Trump came in as like a hero. He was like, "I'm the great white hope." He's like, "Obama gave Black people hope, I'm going to give white people hope," right? And he lied to them. He totally lied to them because he's like, "Oh, what I believe in is money. That's what I actually believe in." But in this piece, you're drawn to the woman, right? You see Trump, he's like this big figure, but your eyes are directly drawn to the white woman who's in black and white and Trump's in color, right? And so the thing is like, for me, it's always centering like the most marginalized in my work. Like, I center black women, I center like queerness, like it's directly related to my spiritual practice, it's related to my activism, it all ties in.
Okay, so can you tell me about your documentary? What it's about?
So my documentary is called Letters to an Unborn Son. And I think it comes out of my experience of being an intersex activist. And I think I have a really complicated story to tell. But I think sometimes with media wants you to tell a certain story, right? They're like, "Oh, we want to talk, you talk about being black or black and intersex or intersex." And I'm like, "Oh, there's layers, right? We're not divorced from our layers." I think sometimes we divorce ourselves from our layers for safety, survival, and belonging. But we're not divorced from our layers. So this documentary is about my dad, who in 1989, he was arrested by the New York Police Department, and he was incarcerated for 4 years. He was charged with attempted murder, and he eventually died in prison from AIDS. I think what's so profound about that, one profound thing, is that was the last time I saw him alive. And to put it in a larger context of state violence, this is the violence that people live with on a daily level. We see it in an international stage. And given that I grew up in the United States is my context, I talk about state violence as it exists right now. And so he was arrested. And I think that was a defining moment for me as a young person, to have my parents snatched away and never seen again. It's a traumatic moment. And so probably like 2 or 3 years ago, my mom gave me a packet, a thick packet, of my dad's letters that he wrote while he was in prison. He wrote to me. He wrote to my mom. He wrote over 1,000 letters, one for every day that he was incarcerated. And those letters, when I read those letters, all these memories started coming back. Things that I had suppressed, right? Because I think to put my life in a context, we're talking about the war on drugs. We're talking about crack flooding inner city communities, destroying like black families. There were a lot of children that ended up in foster care as a result of crack impacting people's families. And we're talking about the rapid expansion of like the prison industrial complex.
Does it hurt you to say that?
It's just like, man, he's terrible sometimes. I'm like, oh. But, you know, you had the rapid expansion of incarcerating the poor, the black, the most marginalized, the people with mental health issues. And so my dad existed at the cross-section of all of those. He had mental health issues. He was crack addicted. He was substance using. And he was black. And so when I read those letters, it brought back all these memories that I guess I had suppressed, right? Because I think in that moment, during that time, like, I was just trying to survive. Like, I didn't, there was so much instability in my life at the time. I think I was just reacting to my environment and not acting. And I think the letters and the responses to these letters is my way of acting, right? Creating this documentary to be an actor, not necessarily acting, but to actually be like, this is his story and this is my story. And there's this intersex story that he had this son that he always wanted but never knew he had. Right, who became his son. So it's like almost like there's the, I guess, the three-dimensional life, physical life conversation, and there's also a spiritual conversation, right? Because I do believe spiritually. I believe that we communicate with ancestors and ancestors communicate with us. So I believe spiritually he's somewhere and he's so much bigger than I can even imagine. But this is like my way of like filling in that gap of the time that he was in prison. Like, these are the things that you missed out on for me. And these are the things that happened to me that you probably never knew.
I'm really interested in the way you speak about it, like, as you being a microcosm for this larger, like, amplifying a larger conversation, essentially, on what you're doing. And it seems like activists are so often a voice for the voiceless, like whether that's for people who are too young or no longer alive to speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how does having the burden of just being your own person but also taking on other people's issues, tackling those two together, how does that affect your role as an activist? Having your own, you know, your own issues and also taking on others and amplifying those.
I think the one thing that comes to mind, it's a little bit of a jumble, so I'm going to try to lay it out as best as I can. I think there's something to be said about, really, for me, when I come into something, I do it with all, like, my heart and soul. And so a few years ago, I was sort of like in leadership at this organization. And I think in part I left because I didn't feel supported as a leader. I didn't feel supported. And I feel like our institutions are set up not to support Black people in leadership, right? I think it's endemic. I think it's an endemic issue. Hence Obama. You know, Obama wasn't perfect, but Obama didn't have a chance, right? And so I think for me, I always try to bring in an intersectional lens or focus to my work. That word intersectional gets thrown around so much. And I try to bring other people with me. And I think I've had my heart broken at times because I want those communities that I'm advocating for, I want them to care as much about me as I do about them, right? So I want Black people to care as much about intersex issues as I love Black people. I want intersex folks to be as passionate about Black liberation as I am passionate about intersex issues, right? And so I think, if I'm honest, I think there have been times when my heart's been broken. And I felt sad, and I felt angry. And I think it's those times that I've had to step back or step away or just do things that I just am really, you know, focus on art, focus on my dog, you know? So I think, yeah, I think for me what has been powerful is being able to connect with, like, my emotions enough to feel those things. So if I haven't answered your question.
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. That brings to mind, you know, how is it that you feel motivated to stay active when it feels like no progress is being made? Mm. If it ever does feel like no progress is being made, you can speak to that.
Eves. Are you like a fly on the wall with some of these meetings?
I can't tell. No, I'm just kidding.
You like, saw Black Panther, turned into a fly.
Yes, I have that Wakandan technology.
You know. To be honest, Eves, I don't know. I don't know. I think I have this burning desire for justice. I think I have this desire for liberation and freedom. The way I live my life is about freedom. And so I feel like it's not enough for me to be free. Like, I want other people to be free. I think I went through that recently. You know, the heartbreak that I was telling you about. That was something very recent for me in the last few years. And I felt very jaded. And for me, it was just a matter of refocusing, right? So, like, a while back, I'll take it a little bit further back, around 2005, 2006. Like, for me as an early activist, like, I would be, like, really just upset about everything, right? Be like, oh, I need to tell you about yourself, blah, blah, blah. You're so fucked up. And I think as I've gotten older, I've been like, let me pick and choose my battles, right? And I think there's also something about redirecting my focus and redirecting my energy. And so for me, when I experienced that heartbreak that I was talking about, I was like, well, what can I put it into? And so for me, you know, talking to my homie, my comrade Pigeon, is just like, how can we, so we have like this loose, very loose, not structured kind of project called like the Intersex Justice Project, where we're actually kind of putting like our desires for like our love for our people, our love for liberation. And we're putting that into really confronting hospitals about what they're continuing to do to intersex children and infants. So for me, that's an example, right? Experiencing this heartbreak, feeling like really heartbroken by the intersex community that they're not taking on, you know, Black liberation, right? The way that I would like to see it. Feeling really kind of used and abused as like a leader. And then being like, well, how can I redirect that into something I really care about, right? Like, I really care about these parts of my identity. Like, how can I redirect that focus into something that I want to do? And I think for me, that reduces the resentment. It reduces the bitterness where I can actually be like, okay, I'm living on purpose. I'm doing what makes me happy, that, you know, keeps me in alignment with the Creator.
When you mentioned, you know, redirecting your focus, I guess that makes me think a lot about efficiency and like, you know, how we also have to recognize that a lot of different people are also active and also providing their own roles. So the way that we all come together and convene is really important and what makes the difference. Like, we can't all do everything at once.
Real time.
And so I guess I'm wondering too, like, how important is it for you to have been, to be surrounded by like-minded people or people who are, you know, like-minded, maybe may not be doing the same thing as you. What role do other people who are also in the community play as far as surrounding you and providing you that sense of community?
Yeah, community is so important, right? Especially for those of us who are queer or for those of us who really live by a model of chosen family. Like, community is so important because I think community, like we were talking about earlier, like burnout, the activism, feeling disappointed, feeling jaded. Like, I think at the end of the day, what keeps us going is the relationships that we have. And I like feel like for me, my community, like there's someone who, like my best friend, my sister, who I've known since 2002. She was the lead organizer at this organization called Fierce in New York City, right? And we've been friends since 2002. Like, she is like, we met in social justice community, but we've been like friends ever since. And we've seen each other through the changes, right? And I think just our relationship has taught me a lot about unconditional love. And I think at the end of it, when we start to pare things down and when we get to the heart of it, I think it really speaks to like our relationships with each other, which kind of get us through these hard times. Man, real talk. That's what's going to get us through these hard times. Real talk. It's our relationships. It's like folks coming through, folks sitting with us, folks feeding us feeding folks, you know? Like throwing rent parties when motherfuckers need rent. Like that's what's gonna feed us ultimately. I don't know if Instagram's gonna feed us. Maybe Instagram can connect us to get fed, you know? But actually it's the relationships that we cultivate is which is gonna feed us.
So you have been active in all different parts of the country, right? Can you talk about what
active in different parts of the country?
Look, you got all the titles. You said it in the beginning,
you
didn't
know,
you?
Well, I don't have hoes in different areas.
I didn't mean it like that. That's funny, though. I didn't even think about that. Can you talk about some of the differences or similarities and differences, if you've seen any, in organizing around the country, like in different places? And also talk about activism and social justice in places like Atlanta that may be like meccas of liberalism within larger, I guess that's for any city in America because all of America is that conservative, problematic place. But, you know, in Atlanta specifically, it's kind of like a bubble in these bubbles, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak to the organizing that I've witnessed because in 2004... No, probably 2005. I was like, I am not going to be an organizer because I was like, it is a lot of work. It is burning me out. I don't get to see anything. All I do is come home and watch TV. It's not a sustainable lifestyle for me. So I give it up to the organizers who are like out there making shit happen. Like I've been recently inspired by the bailouts that was initiated by Mary Hooks and the folks at Southern News on Newground. That's been really deeply inspiring. They've been in coalition with other groups here in the metro Atlanta area to really push for the end of cash bail and other, like, to really push, like, our government, our city government, to stop criminalizing folks for quality of life issues, right? So I think that's inspiring here in Atlanta. Right, because I think sometimes Atlanta can really, and you know, you from Atlanta. I'm coming out as an outsider, so I just want to let that be the caveat.
No, you've been here long enough.
That's true.
I'm not one of those who's like ITP OTP.
But you know what, you could be, and I'll defer. I'll be like, you know what, Eves, you got it. But I think that Atlanta kind of rests on its laurels. Right? Being like, oh, we're the birthplace of Martin Luther King and we're about civil rights and so forth and so on. Meanwhile, every corporation has a building in Atlanta, right? And I think what I've seen living in Southwest Atlanta is the disproportionate displacement of like the poor and the disregard for the black poor here in the city, right? That prides itself on civil rights and human rights. So it's been really inspiring, especially with the advent of Black Lives Matter, just to see young people, your millennial folks, getting like turned up and really just doing a level of organizing that has been unprecedented in a long time, right? Because I think we all got a little bit comfortable. And so I think that's been inspiring to watch because I think the youth energy is what carries us forward. I think when we look at social movements, it's been inspired by so many young people, right? And so I think what I've witnessed is this energy, this fervor that I hope we can keep stoking that fire. Right. And I think as the conditions get more harsh and more cruel, it's going to require people to be out in the streets. Right. Like when I was out in Chicago, motherfuckers are like ready. You hear? People are ready. They are like watching. And I think what's really interesting and strategic about the organizing that's going on in Chicago is that people are informing each other about each other's movements. Because I think sometimes what happens is that power, the powers that exist in the United States, they play upon the division that exists, that people are not informed about other people's movements, right? And I think when people educate each other on each other's movements, like their tactics, their strategies, their liberation ideologies, I think that serves as a great force for change. It might be idealistic on my part, right? But I think I kind of think about the stories that I've heard of, so say, for instance, in New York City, where I'm from, this Sylvia Rivera and the trans women who started STAR. I think it's the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. I forgot the...
it's hard to keep up with acronyms sometimes.
You know what I'm saying? All I remember it as is STAR. Mm-hmm. And they were in conversation with the Young Lords, which was this Puerto Rican gang that existed in the South Bronx, in Harlem, in New York City, right? And the Young Lords actually had respect and admiration and love for these trans women, right? They were in conversation with each other's movements because they're like, we're all getting arrested. We're all getting our ass kicked. We're all getting like fucking beat up and raped by the cops, right? So we have to be kind of like on the pulse of what each other is doing. And I'm like, what would that look like? Right? What would that look like if, as part of our organizing strategies, if we're really like, oh, I may not agree, and I've seen this recently, right? Like, people are like, I may not agree or understand the transgenders, or I may not be comfortable with the queers, but I can also say that, like, your liberation is tied in with my liberation. And I'm going to fight, you know, and maybe there's a campaign that we can work on. Maybe there's points of overlap, right? And I think that's what made, here in Atlanta, that's what made the cash bail ordinance come into effect. Because people were like, I may not understand the transgenders. I may not necessarily want to hear about your same-sex relationship. But the thing is, cash bail affects everyone. If you're poor, you're living on the street, you don't have money, it affects you, right? And groups were able to come together on that platform. So I'm hoping that we can see more of that in the coming weeks, months, and years.
Yeah, that conversation about seeing other people's struggles, even if they don't understand it or not, really ties in. And you say you're spiritual, like, to me, really reminds me of a spiritual conversation as well about a lot of people don't understand about connectedness and that that we're too focused on the divisions and the binaries and the separation of each other when at the end of the day, we are all part of the same web. You'll hear more from Sypha after this short break. So I also was thinking about, you know, how we all are focused on, you know, we're all different. Like, if there's one thing we would have realized by now is that we're all different and that we're still learning. Why do you think that we, as humans, but as Americans in particular, are so obsessed with what's normal?
This idea of normalcy is very compelling. It's very compelling for parents, right? So for me, it's like speaking as an intersex activist, the reason why parents are duped into these surgeries for their kids is because of this compelling notion of normalcy. I don't think normalcy exists, right? It's something that we definitely created. It's based on very old, very white, very male, white male notions of what it means to be normal that a lot of people don't fit into. I don't think even some of these white men fit into, right? And I mean, wow. Normalcy, I think is actually very oppressive. And I think that's what's dictating the very biased legislation that's coming out. I think it's filling up our jails and our prisons. Because even though it's driven by money, it's also driven by what we consider normal. Because if we deem someone as not being normal, it's easier for us to persecute them, right? Even, especially when we're talking about the state, right? If someone is not normal, then it's like, oh, then what is it? I forgot. I saw a headline recently where there was a state, maybe it was California, but I don't know if it was California, where they adopted into law that people with disabilities would be paid the same as other people, right? And you'd be like, shouldn't everybody be getting paid the same? But because of, like, how we think about people who are disabled, it's like, oh, okay, it's okay not to pay them as much because we don't consider them normal, you know? But then what the fuck is normal? But whatever it is, it's definitely very oppressive.
It's creating some false sense of security.
I guess
Some false narrative, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think the current state of America is affecting the way that people want to be involved in activism?
I think only time will tell. I think it's one, and this is just my perspective. So I think there are people who are getting really pumped, right? I think it's really galvanizing people. Because I think it's interesting that I guess we, even though extrajudicial killings by police of black people have existed for a long time, it was interesting under the Obama administration that it became a very central issue, mm-hmm. right? And I think that with Trump's administration, it's definitely been like, ooh, people are definitely seeing, because I think the effects are profound. Like his administration and the Republicans and people who are supporting him are just taking the opportunity to channel all of their bias and codify their bias. And these are codified laws that we've lived with that are inherently biased. But I think it's a time that is going to motivate people to action, or it's actually going to scare people. Because I feel like I talk to people who are scared, righteously scared, right? Like, especially with Homeland Security, with the CIA, FBI. Like, people have every right to be scared. Because who wants to, like, rot in prison or be executed by the state, right? So I think as we're moving, as the pressure is kind of pushing us in, I think it's either going to get people into action or people are going to be moved to inaction.
So let's change pace.
Okay.
And let's talk about healing.
Ooh.
Okay. So what do you think some modes of healing from trauma are? And I know you Ooh. Mentioned somatics.
Yeah.
I just want to know more about that.
Ooh. You want to learn? You
yeah,
wanna
I
learn
do
more
want
to
educate
the somatics.
Me. Educate me.
Well, you know. So there's an organization in Oakland, California called Generative Somatics. And somatics is about movement, right? Engaging the body. So anything can be somatic, right? You do yoga. That's a somatic form of movement, right? It engages the body. Us sitting here talking is somatic movement. But there's some somatic practices that actually speak to trauma. And I think the way I like to think about trauma, I don't know if I have a clear definition of trauma, but the way I think about it is that there are these points in history that become like frozen, that freeze us, that allow us to move forward. Because I think if the brain took in all the information, the psychic information, the physical information, the brain has a beautiful way of filtering so that we don't, you know, go nutty. It has to be able to do that. But I think in order to get through really hard points in our life, it has to freeze around that. And I think I've seen it in my own life. I've seen it with other people. When we get to a place where it reaches kind of where we're in a place of homeostasis, that's when the body starts releasing the things, starts releasing the toxins, right? Because if you have to kind of muscle through something, you're just kind of like muscling through. It's adrenaline. It's like these physical processes in the body. So all that to say, for me, I had done a child sexual abuse training in 2008. And I was like, well, you know, I don't consider myself a survivor, so forth and so on, in that way. And when I was going through this 3-day training, like every day after the training, like my body would literally lock up. Like my muscles would just like cramp up. It was bad. And I talked to a friend, and she was like, you're having a somatic response to the content. What? What are you talking about?
Trying to tell me about myself?
What you talking about? I think from then on, that's when I was like, well, how do I start unlocking this trauma? And I got involved with this organization called Generative Somatics. And their focus is on addressing trauma through somatic practices. And they see that trauma is shaped by oppression. Because there's the trauma that we experience, and there's trauma shaped by oppression. The systemic oppression, right, that affects people, it affects the body. What has there been studies saying that people don't live as long because of the impact of racism? We've known that. It causes high blood pressure, all these different health conditions. But now it's actually documented, right? So it impacts our bodies, and it impacts our psyches. And so for me, I see healing so beautifully and intimately tied with liberation, right? Because for me, the trauma that I've received has been at the level of the body, right? It's like, imagine someone who's in prison, who's been locked down, like literally being in solitary confinement for years at a time. That is maddening. When people come out on the other side of that, we're doing that to human beings. So it's one thing to talk about it in therapy, and I think that works for people. Sometimes it works for me. And I think there's something else about really being with someone, really being with their body, to say, like, you can rest. In this moment, you can rest, and you can release all of those toxins, all of that pain that you just had to contain. Right?
There's also the element of being able to recognize the trauma first before you get to address it.
Okay,
and I
Eve.
Know that there are a lot of people who haven't gotten to that point yet.
That's
you know,
real.
This. So I guess I'm wondering how you think that, if you have an answer, mm-hmm. we can get to the point collectively mm. and we can all talk to each other about recognizing it first, realizing mm. that it's a reality, mm. and then moving forward to address it.
Eve's coming with the deep questions. Wow. I mean, I think that would be beautiful, right? If we can talk about what we have experienced without shame. Because I think the isolating thing about trauma is shame. Like, how does someone who has been raped by their father, how do they talk about that trauma? Or a man who's been raped by another man, how does he talk about that without necessarily confronting shame? I mean, I think there's so much shame around. I think we have a society that shames us. We have a society that breeds sort of isolation and being disconnected from each other, being disconnected from ourselves, right? So I think on a collective level, man, I wish there can be as many people doing healing work as there are soldiers, right? People who can really sit with other people's pain. Like we were talking about earlier, right? Like the art of conversation, the art of listening. Like I think it may not necessarily be on that systemic level yet, but what does it mean if I'm sitting across from you, looking you in your eyes, like listening to what you're saying and like allowing what you're sharing with me, allow it to impact me, right? And what I share impact you. I mean, it doesn't have to be on this broader level of collective healing, but I think if it can just start there, right? If we're talking to each other, not like we're talking on Facebook, on Instagram, but really like being with each other and not trying to fix it, not trying to change it, not trying to be like, oh, you need to see a therapist or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because people do that too, right? It's just like you come with a problem or you come with something that's really on your heart and immediately a lot of people go into, you know, kind of like this mode of like, oh, let me address that. Because I think sometimes it's hard for us to sit with other people's emotion, to sit with people's sadness, to sit with people's rage, you know? Because I feel like our society really is sterilizing, unless it's in these ways that we come to expect. So if it's like we watch, well, does Oprah still have a show?
She has a whole network.
That's true. She got her own. That's right.
She's manifesting and calling it own, though.
Let me tell you. Right. So if we actually tune in, then we can prepare ourselves for somebody's emotions. But what if we are just allow ourselves just to kind of be with someone's emotions and not have it be structured?
You brought up the idea of like when we were at the meeting a couple of weekends ago about there being a sort of violence in the communication between a therapist or a psychologist and the person who they're talking to. Can you talk a little bit about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes we can be really disconnected, especially if we're in academia, especially if we're in these professions where there's like a hard boundary between us and the other person. I think it's a violence that happens, especially if we're talking about trauma, especially if we're talking about people's histories. Because I think we are obligated to be really present with people, especially if they're talking about trauma, right? To be sort of like, if I'm a psychologist, if I'm a therapist, and I'm just removed and taking notes or just listening, but, you know, waiting so I can share my opinion, you know, it's just like, I feel like it's a disservice. Like for me, I see a therapist who's wonderful and amazing. Her name is Mara Collins here in Atlanta, Georgia. And what makes her so dope is that she's able to sort of be with me in my experience. Like she really directly relates to my experience. And in ways, if she can't relate to my experience, I'm still able to feel like really heard and really held in that, right? I think it's part of the larger conversation we've been having about, like, can we sit with people's pain, you know? Whether we be professional or not in our role, like, can we be with people's pain? Because there's a lot of pain in the world right now.
It seems like people are also having a really hard time, like, when it comes to bodies, understanding autonomy and choice and consent. And how do we go about dealing with this idea that other people have control over our own bodies? Essentially, somebody else owns it, even though that might not be in a practice or something that's legislatively happening, although it is in those conversations, but just the conversation between those in power and those who are oppressed, that manifestation of that somebody owns your body.
I mean, I wish people would talk about it. You know, so I totally get so angry and annoyed at these legislators who are men who want to pass legislation about women's bodies. That makes no sense, right? So they don't necessarily come out and say, we own your body, but all of this conversation suggests that they do, right? And so I think in order to recognize people's body autonomy, we have to see them as human first. And I think the problem is we don't see people as human. So the example that I think about is for people who are incarcerated, people who are locked down, they're considered property of the state. Like, I've talked to formerly incarcerated people, and if they do, you know, especially if they're in solitary, if they're suicidal, that's considered damaging state property. Fuck out of here. That is bananas, right? And so we don't necessarily, maybe more so with prison, we may be like, these bodies are property of the state, but we don't. And because of that, by extension, it's just like, well, because those people are bad, because they're in prison, they have no rights. They have no right to bodily autonomy. So we can do anything. Like, back in the day, not still going on, but the sterilization of women in prison. Like, these are things that have happened because they're not considered human. So if I'm wondering, like, if what needs to shift in our society for people to actually be seen as human, where their bodies can be respected? And I think it's a really important conversation that's happening right now that you touched on, right? In light of, like, the Me Too, and I think there was another hashtag going around. But again, women's bodies are not seen as theirs, right? Like, women's bodies are seen for the pleasure and for the dominance of men and masculinity. That's the problem, you know? Like, with intersex kids, it's just like, intersex people are not seen as human. So it's just like, yeah, let's just cut these people up to make them normal. Going to what we were talking about around normalcy. So I wonder what needs to happen and what needs to shift in our society where we actually start to humanize people.
Okay, so we're going to switch back a little bit again, too, to talk about activism. That's cool with you?
Okay, that's cool.
There seems to be a lot of misinformation going around, and that, you know, fact-based evidence and research and truth is not always it's not an expected part of conversations a lot of the time now. How much does just straight education play a role in your activism? Like, just here are the facts. And if you want to speak to the larger idea of facts and misinformation in our culture around
all
social
facts.
Justice right now, yeah, all facts, then that's cool too.
Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I feel like we can talk about facts because there are some people who love facts, right? They don't want to hear your personal story. They just want to hear the facts. So I can tell my personal story and they'd be like, well, what are the numbers of children born intersex? So for me, I think right now what feels very important is for people, kind of like what I was saying before around people being human or being humanized. I think we can talk about, so when we talk about folks who are being deported, we can give numbers about the number of deportations that happen every year, but what happens when we actually hear the stories and the impact it has on people's lives and family structures, right? Like, literally, ICE agents coming in the middle of the night and removing people, or, you know, a father dropping his daughter off to school and she never sees her dad again because he's picked up and deported, right? So what happens? Like, I think I'm really interested. I think facts are important. But I think sometimes facts can be debated, right? Because you come with one set of facts and then someone comes with another set of facts. But I think there's something about people's stories that feels really important. Like, how do we really share our stories and let those stories manifest on a bigger level? That's why I'm really inspired by people's stories that I'm hearing of, like, people who are Muslim and who are being attacked, or, like, people who have family members who are being deported, or trans folks who are, like, you know, this legislation is, like, literally trying to take away my body autonomy and really is killing me on a, like, micro and macro level. We can debate facts, but I think it's, like, I'm appreciating these stories that really humanize these facts, that work in tandem with these facts.
So I want to wrap up with, on a positive note.
Yes, positivity.
What is something that makes you happy right now that you see going on in the social justice community?
I think there's a few things that make me happy. I think in this iteration of Black liberation, I think it's really dope to see, like, how we're just really appreciative and how much we love each other, you know? It may be superficial. Some of us may believe it more than others. But I think it's really, like, with the premiere of Black Panther, like, people were showing out, doing all of the things, and I was here for it, right? Because I think I'm like, oh, wow, this is, like, really just dope to see. And I think people were just really kind of stepping up and like fighting back. But also I think people are employing different like tactics. You know, it's not about like this, I think with some people it may be, but it's not about this like hard, I'm going to organize, I'm going to, you know, leave people behind. But I feel like there's like inclusivity, like the founders of Black Lives Matter, three Black women, right, who were really centering like queer people, trans people, right? Like this is amazing. That's to me like inspiring. I'm inspired by people who are like having conversations around how can we heal relationships in our movements? Because I think sometimes there's infighting that happens in social justice movements that can legit tear movements apart. Distrust, dishonesty, backstabbing, you know, these are things that can really impact our movements. And I'm glad that people are really starting to have those conversations. And I'm inspired by, like, the young people. Like, I think for me it feels like a good time to be alive because I think when Trump got elected, people were just like, this is the end of the world. I might as well give up here, you know? And in spite of that, for some people, when the shock subsided, people were like, oh, I'm going to use my voice, I'm going to use my stories to speak to the injustices that I'm witnessing right now. So I feel like this is a great time for art. This is a great time for making art. If you're an artist and you're making political art, this is a dope time to be doing it, right? Like, because you can really get some messages across. You can really speak to people. So I think sometimes, especially when I'm on Facebook, I'm a relic. Looking at my timeline, just seeing what people are talking about, it can be depressing. And I can really feel like bummed out and feel despair, especially when reading about state violence and just reading about like these things that are just like, this is heinous. This is heinous. I feel scared. I feel hopeless. But then I also feel like there are like glimmers of like hope, you know, by the things that I mentioned. It's like, oh, this gives me a hope, like to go back to what I was talking about earlier about liberation. Like this gives me the wings to transgress these current conditions.
I think that's a great note to end on. You did that so poetically. Look at that. You were trying to do it.
You know, Eves. I know you appreciate that.
I do. So now that you've heard more from Sypha, I wanted to let you all know that we have a lot of other great interviews that we're going to let you all hear in the coming weeks. So look forward to that. Afropunk Solution Sessions is a co-production between Afropunk and How Stuff Works. Your hosts are Bridget Todd and Eves Jeffcoat. Executive co-producers are Julie Douglas, Jocelyn Cooper, and Quan Latif Hill. Dylan Fagan is supervising producer and audio engineer. Many, many thanks to Casey Pegram and Annie Reese for their production and editorial oversight. And many thanks to our on-the-ground Atlanta crew, Ben Boland, Corey Oliver, and Noel Brown. The Underside of Power is performed by Algiers. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @Afropunk.